I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Evan Thomas. His new book is Road to Surrender, Three Men and the Countdown to the End of World War II in the Pacific. It is now the spring of 1945. We turn to the Japanese point of view with a man by the name of Togo, Shigenori Togo. What is most striking about him is that he was twice in the cabinet. The first time during the raid on Pearl Harbor. He resigned 8 months after Pearl Harbor and retreated into his philosophy. The second time, he was called back by the emperor, and he is in place for these last days of the war, before and after the atomic bomb. Evan, what do we need to know about Togo? Because we spend a great deal of time inside his point of view in these last hours.
Japan is run by something called the Supreme War Council, six people. War minister, chief of staff of the army and navy, prime minister, they're all military people. The one civilian is Shigenori Togo. He's the foreign minister. And significantly, he's the only one who wants to surrender. His goal, and he remains fixed on it, is to try to figure out how to get the emperor, who is the nominal head of Japan, divine, but actually under the control pretty much of the military. His goal is to get the emperor to surrender. And that's why I focus on him, because he's singular. He's the only one at the top who wants to do this. He succeeds, but it is a close-run thing.
He's an unusual Japanese speaker, you make the case, because he's blunt, he's direct. He doesn't spend a deal of time presenting what you'd have to say is ambiguous remarks. And that is a strength or a weakness when he's dealing with the military?
Well, he's different, and it helps to have somebody who is blunt. But, of course, the military doesn't want to hear it because they want to control him. In Japan, there's something called haragai, which is I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this exactly right, but it means the stomach game. The Japanese, certainly, I think then, now, too, to some extent, but certainly then, at the top, they communicated indirectly. And you were supposed to know what the other guy was saying. This allowed for a lot of face saving if you avoided open confrontations. The military did not like Togo forcing this issue. They wanted to control the show, and they wanted to fight to the end. And so Togo was a brave guy. He could easily have gotten himself assassinated. In the 1930s, three Japanese prime ministers were assassinated. It was called government by assassination. And it was a very real risk that if you cross the military, and particularly infuriated the junior officers who were the hotheads, the militants, you could get yourself killed. So Togo was a brave guy. He was running the risk of assassination.
There's a legend that is critical to understand in the final hours of the war and how the Japanese serving military and the civilians dealt with each other's intentions, some to suicide, some to surrender. It's called 47 Ronin. What is that, Evan? What is 47 Ronin, and what was it to the men in 1945?
It was a legend from a couple of centuries earlier, but it was hugely popular in Japanese culture. And it involved a lord who kills a higher lord and has to kill himself. And then his knights, his samurai, his 47 Ronin, his leaderless samurai, want to avenge his death. It takes them 2 years. They do it. They kill the guy who killed their guy, and then they all commit suicide. It's a grisly, convoluted little tale, but it was an important national myth. This idea of honor through death is deeply baked into the Japanese society of that time.
The Big Six all evidence parts of 47 Ronin. The most important, given the crisis of these last days, is the war minister, Anami. What was Togo's relationship with Anami?
Well, it's complicated because they're speaking in this Japanese way of honoring each other, even as their opponents. Anami poses as the samurai, the fight to the death guy. And in the end, Anami kills himself. He's not just posing. He takes a sword and jabs it into his belly. But he is although his, although Togo is his opponent, there is some respect there. And it's not clear really where Togo's coming from, where Anami's coming from, because although he blusters and threatens to fight to the end and to stage a coup, he doesn't actually do it. He could have brought down the government. He doesn't do it. So there's an element of he may have been posturing himself, playing a role and forcing Togo to go to the emperor, go around him. But with a certain amount of winking and nodding, it's a little bit unclear. It's a little bit mysterious.
Nothing about this is easy to understand. And we need to spend a moment with the emperor, Hirohito, who has a reedy voice, Evans reporting, a thin, metallic-like reedy voice, is a diminutive person. However, he's been raised to be worshipped, and he derives his power from God, not from the people, is the opinion. What is the emperor's relationship to this big six, the army, the navy, the prime minister, the foreign minister, and the war minister? Do they have a one-to-one relationship? Who obeys whom?
In theory, the emperor reports to God. He's divine. But in fact, his legitimacy is dependent on the military. So it's a very uneasy dance. They nominally, the military, the big six, the war council, reports to the emperor. But in practice, the big six would make a decision. They'd come to the emperor, and the emperor would say nothing. Silent assent. The idea was to keep the emperor above politics, not to soil him with politics. That, of course, gave the military tremendous power. But in my story and in history, at the end of the war, the emperor, who's a rather meek figure, unprepossessing figure, does assert himself, partly, I think, to save his own skin. He's afraid the next atom bomb is going to drop on him. But he does assert himself, and he does stand up to the military. It takes some courage to do that.
Standing up to the military means dealing with the Prime Minister Suzuki, who's anything you want him to be. I couldn't tell. Oftentimes, Suzuki would, was that the stomach game? He would say what he didn't believe, and then he would say what he did believe, and you couldn't choose.
It's hard to know. Suzuki carried the bullets, four bullets from assassins. He had been a target of assassination in 1936. This is very Japanese. As his assassins are standing over him and he's bleeding, his wife comes in and she says, "Let me finish the job. Give me the sword." And the assassins give her the sword. They leave. She saves her husband. Talk about being a good wife. And this is an extremely Japanese scene. It's out of Shakespeare or something even more gothic. But the point is that Suzuki remembers the assassins. And so he's darned if he's going to get shot again. And so he's all over the place. It's hard to tell where he is. I still don't really know where he ended up. He was kind of he's also very old. He's a Taoist. He's developed this very passive Far Eastern philosophical view. So he kind of just floats to the wind. He's not a decisive figure.
And Togo has to deal with these personalities and their strengths and has to deal with them, even though he's not quite trusting of what they want. But they have in mind an end that is quite different than either negotiating a surrender. They want Hondo Kessen, I wrote it down, the final battle. What will that look like, Evan?
Apocalypse. They want to force the Americans to invade. They have waiting for the American invasion force a million men on the beach. Our invasion force was about 900,000. 7,000 kamikazes, all sorts of kamikazes, swimmers, frogmen, soldiers, and 28 million civilians who have been put under arms now, crude arms, you know, rakes and spears. But, you know, a fighting force of a type, a civilian army. So the battle for Japan would have been grotesque. You know, it took us we lost 7,000 people to take Iwo Jima. 5 weeks, 7,000 people. Iwo Jima is an island the size of Nantucket. Okinawa, 12,000 men, 2 months. That's a bigger island, but still, if we'd had to fight this final battle, it would have been a bloodbath from one end of the Japanese main islands to the other, and we would probably have settled. This is what the Japanese wanted. They had a death wish, but it wasn't totally crazy. They wanted good terms. They wanted no American occupation and no war crimes trials and keep the emperor. That was not nuts, because if they'd forced us to invade, it was called the bleeding strategy, Shiketsu, and they had bled us enough, we might have given them what they wanted.
That's what they had been doing since Guadalcanal, sacrificing their army, not being able to resupply it, thinking the Americans at any point will negotiate when their losses get too strong. Now, one detail for Togo. He has a plan B. The Russians. What did Togo imagine was possible with Moscow?
Even though Russia is historically Japan's enemy, they had a mutual non-aggression pact that was running out. And Togo, a diplomat, thinks that he can use Russia as a kind of a mediator, that Russia is an ally of the United States and Britain, and maybe Russia could mediate some kind of peace that would give the Japanese good terms. That was a forlorn wish. The Russians played Togo. They let the process go on, and then at the very last moment when the Japanese ambassador arrives to see the Russian foreign minister, the Russian foreign minister announces, well, we're declaring war on you, and that night hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers pour into Japanese-occupied Manchuria, and now Japan is facing war on a new front. That happens the night before we drop the second atom bomb.
The book is The Road to Surrender, Three Men in the Countdown to the End of the World War II. Evan Thomas is the author. We need to meet the men who are going to be responsible for dropping the atomic bomb and their commanders. When we come back, I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to The Wealth Break.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone. It's not just about saving. It's about investing. It's about navigating systems that weren't built for you, embracing your hustle, and relying on your community to create something bigger.
And that's exactly why we created The Wealth Break. We made something different, something more human. It's not just another financial podcast. It's a conversation about real life, real struggles, and real wins.
We're here to talk about the journey. You're here from people who've broken barriers, found creative ways to succeed, and learned to build wealth on their terms. Whether it's the first-time homeowner, a gig worker, or someone turning a side hustle into a six-figure business, we're bringing you their stories.
And we're not stopping at success stories. We're breaking down the realities, like what it means to take risk, how to navigate failure, and why resilience matters. Because wealth isn't about money. It's about creating a life where you can thrive and help others to do the same.
So if you're ready for a podcast as much as about people as it is about money, you're in the right place.
Listen to The Wealth Break podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Having MG can make cooking difficult, but over the years, I've found some really helpful tools and tips that I'm excited to share. Hi, I'm Alicia. I think cooking should always be fun, creative, and of course, delicious. These black bean burgers are hearty, full of flavor, and MG friendly. You're gonna love them.
Check out Alicia's Black Bean Burger cooking video and other recipes full of tips and tricks for managing common MG symptoms while cooking only at mg-united.com.
Ready? Let's cook.